three things in human life are important. The first is to be kind. The second is to be kind. The third is to be kind. So that's Henry James. That's a quote I rather like. We could maybe paraphrase that. There's three things in the spiritual life are important. The first is to act with metta, or loving kindness. The second is to act with metta. The third is to act with metta. So yes, I'm going to talk about metta, loving kindness, which come. I've just written this book, Mindful Emotion: A Short Course in Kindness. So yeah, publicity, you know, promotion, which is a sort of the occasion for me being here. I'm going to also so Sangharakshita, Bhante, who I'll refer to him as Bhante, that's an honorific title for teacher, has written a very good commentary on the Metta Sutta called Living with Kindness, and I'll quote quite a lot from that as well. I think there's some lovely bits in there. So right at the very end of the book, he says, "The way of Metta is not only a path of ever-increasing positive emotion leading to enlightenment. It is a guide to recovering our basic human inheritance of joy." So I really like that. So it's partly saying that it's a path to enlightenment, a path to awakening. It's a way to the goal as in, and an expression of the goal. But it's also about recovering our human inheritance. It's a, if you like, metta is an expression of our basic humanity. We could say that to be really human is to be kind. So what I'm going to do in the talk is I'm going to talk about a bit about kindness or metta as the path to and the expression of the goal of the spiritual life. But before that, I'm going to say a bit about what metta is and talk about two of the applications of metta in daily life. So, what is metta? So again, just a couple of quotes from Living with Kindness. So first of all, "Developed to its full intensity, metta is a down-to-earth care and concern directed to all living beings equally, individually and without reservation. The unfailing sign of metta is that you are deeply concerned for the well-being, happiness, and prosperity of the object of your metta." So what's being said here is, you know, one of the key things, it's about a concern for the people and indeed beings that we share this planet with, and that it's active. So it's not just a feeling, so it's not just sort of feeling great. It's about doing something. And the second one, "Metta is love that breaks out of the narrow confines of self-referential selectivity, love that does not have a preference, non-exclusive love. If we're going to use the word love at all, we could describe metta as disinterested love. It is, of course, interested in the sense of concerned. It is not uninterested, but it is disinterested in the sense that when you feel it, you have no thought of what you might get back in return." So, yes, it's not about getting something back. It's open in that way. So, it's actually a very high ideal, metta, loving kindness, a very high ideal. So it's often, as I said, it's often translated as loving kindness. The word metta itself is slightly problematic in the sense that it's a sort of, you know, foreign word and can sound rather cool, perhaps. But there are, of course, also problems when we do translate it. So it can be translated as love, which has got more of an emotional resonance. But it also can be a bit vague. So, you know, like, I love chocolate. It's not that I feel metta for chocolate, although maybe I should do. But, you know, it can do that. It can also, love can also be sentimental. I did as in fact can the word kindness that I'm going to mention in a moment. I did a few years ago, I was giving a talk on kindness behaviour training, which is a course that this book describes. So I was doing a PowerPoint presentation, so I wanted an image of kindness. I googled kindness and images. Oh my goodness. So the sort of thing you got was like a little wee kitten with a fluffy chicken.
Aww.
That's right. So when I said this in the audience, I've got a few, it's quite sweet, but actually for me that's a bit sentimental. That's not really what kindness or love in the sense of metta is really about. So yes, I've preferred the word kindness. Partly, it goes back a long way. The etymology goes back before 900 years of the Common Era. It goes back to the Old English, apparently, gekind or gekinder. I'm afraid my Old English pronunciation is not very good. Well, if I don't know how you do it. It means something like natural, native, innate. It originally comes from the word meaning family, and we get the word kin from it. So in other words, what this seems to imply is that kindness in a way is a natural state. It's a way that we might be predisposed to our family. You know, family problems notwithstanding, but you know, just the sort of way that we might naturally be responded. And so when I was developing this course, Kindness Behaviour Training, I chose to use the word kindness rather than the Latinate word compassion, which to me is just slightly more distant. There's quite an interest in compassion, particularly self-compassion, in the therapeutic work, in the therapeutic world. But I prefer to use the word kindness. So, before I go any further, I just want to do a little disclaimer. So, I'm up here talking about metta and kindness, so you might think that, you know, I'm a love type, or a kindness type, or something like that. Actually, I'm someone who's really struggled with the metta bhavana. Give me a choice between the mindfulness of breathing and the metta bhavana, I'll probably choose the mindfulness of breathing every time. So how come I ended up writing a book and developing a course on kindness? Well, the main reason is because I was asked to. So after I finished being chairman at the LBC, I had a sabbatical, and when I came back, a good friend of mine, Maitreya Bandhu, asked me if I would do a course to follow on from our breathing space courses. So at the LBC, we've got breathing space where we teach mindfulness-based courses to help with depression, anxiety, stress, addiction, and so on. And he was thinking it'd be good to have a sort of follow-on course that included metta. And I could completely see his point. I thought, oh, crumbs, because that means I'll have to actually pay more attention to metta. And as I say, it's not something I felt particularly good at, but I felt it was important. So, as I mentioned, it came out as this idea of a sort of follow-on from one of the mindfulness courses. So mindfulness has become very, very popular in the wider society. In our own order and movement, I think that hasn't been always the case. I remember back in, I think it was about 1991, there was an order member called Amla Vajra who gave a talk, "Is there mindfulness in the order?" with a kind of implication of, no, there isn't. So actually, despite the fact that our teacher, Thangaratcha, is very, very mindful, a lot of us were perhaps not so very mindful. And Amla Vajra had been to Plum Village, which is where Thich Nhat Hanh is based, and Thich Nhat Hanh's very hot on sort of daily mindfulness. So we all came back and we started doing mindfulness, having washing the dishes and having mindfulness bells and things. But I think actually the real thing that's made a big difference has actually been the sort of these mindfulness-based courses like mindfulness-based cognitive therapy and mindfulness-based stress reduction, which are quite thoroughgoing in looking at how you practice mindfulness in your everyday life. And now also we've got Maitreya Bandhu's book, Life with Full Attention, which in a way brings that more fully back into the sort of Buddhist tradition. So we got these, I think we have got much better as a community at practicing mindfulness, not just on the cushion, but also off the cushion. But maybe not so much with Metta-Bhavana. At least I don't think it's been given quite the same attention. So when I was designing the course, I was very keen that we looked at not just how do we do the Metta-Bhavana, but also how do we practice Metta in our daily life. Because the two reinforce each other. And of course, the more we're able to practice kindness in our daily lives, the more that actually when we sit down to do the Metta-Bhavana practice, it will be, well, it'll just be the natural state rather than something we have to grit our teeth. Not that we should ever grit our teeth to cultivate Metta, but sometimes that was certainly my experience. It's sort of, I don't know, if you're familiar with the toothpaste version of it, you know, where you've got a tooth and you squeeze out the Metta. But to other people, anyway, that's not how to do Metta. But certainly, I think, how I used to try and do it. As I said, one of the main emphases in the course that I developed was about practicing Metta in daily life. And so I particularly want to look at a couple of the applications of Metta in this talk. But before we do that, we do need to know what Metta is and isn't. We need to be sort of basically mindful of our emotions and what's going on. Now, one of the things that I found helpful, so when I was designing the course, I was sort of looking at what was going on out there. And as I mentioned, there's quite a bit going on in terms of compassion. And in particular, there's a thing called compassion-focused therapy developed by a psychologist called Paul Gilbert. And he draws on evolutionary psychology, which suggests that there are three main emotion regulation systems, and they are threat, drive, and the soothing system. So the threat system is a very basic system that we share with all animal life, which is basically to look out for danger, and then we respond with either sort of wanting to attack, to fight, to run away, to submit, or with a sense of disgust. So those are the sort of responses that we get to threat. It's very easily triggered, that system. It needs to be. So it's like if you're crossing the road and suddenly a car comes around the corner, you need to get out of the way. You can't sort of think about it. Think, I'm now practicing mindfulness, and that appears to be a car. So it has to operate very, very quickly. The drive system is about directing us towards what's important, towards things that are rewarding. So whether that's sort of pleasure things like food and sex, or sort of more sort of life goals like, you know, getting the job interview, or, you know, doing well at work, things like that. So it sort of drives us towards that. And when we achieve our goal, we get a sense of a boost of pleasure. Now, as far as I understand, reptiles, we share this with reptiles, they have these things. But what you see when you get to mammals and to birds is a change in way of operating. So that whereas reptiles produce lots of offspring and then let them get on with it, what you have with mammals is you have just fewer number of offspring, but you take care of them. And this is where the soothing system comes in. So it's also called the affiliation system. So it's about sort of building relationships. So the sort of most obvious one would be between the mother and her child. And, you know, when the child gets upset, if, you know, you've got a good enough mother, then she will soothe the child. So we've got that, and that, you know, if we think of humans, they are very much social animals. You know, we work together, and those bonds of affiliation operate through this system. And it's this, if you remember when I was talking about the etymology of kindness, it goes back to, well, originally to family. So it's sort of out of this system that in a way that kindness comes. It's like kind of, you know, within this system you've got the seeds of kindness and indeed of, well, loving kindness of metta. So it's got these three systems. It also gets, but it does get a bit complicated because as well as having these emotion systems, we've got very clever brains that are able to do complex thinking, which, you know, does fantastic things like, you know, builds Buddhist centres like this, creates rupas like that, you know, medicines, technology, all sorts of things, but can also create their own problems. So, for example, if you're a gazelle, no, you're not, but if you were a gazelle and you're on the savannah and a lion suddenly appears, you would do a runner for it. If you're lucky enough to get away, as far as I know, when the gazelle gets away, he or she doesn't sit there thinking, oh, that was a really close call, that was so terrible. I mean, I nearly got eaten by that lion and, you know, I'm never going to go to that oasis again. It's like, I mean, it looks really good, but tell you what, those lions are really fierce and that was a really nasty, brutal, you know, sort of thing. As far as we know, gazelles don't do that. They just get on, get over it, as it were. Whereas we can really go into ruminating about painful things. So a painful thing can happen that stimulates, for example, the threat system, and then we can just ruminate over and over again about it, and it just keeps it going. So we can end up with an overactive threat system, and that's terribly common. So when we're practicing metta, whether it's on the cushion or off the cushion, we need to be sort of, in a way, we need to sort of know which system is operating. Because if we're in the threat or the drive system, we're going to need to do a bit of work to, in a way, shift more into the affiliation system. Or even sort of bring some kindness to what's going on. If we're sort of like really aroused and feeling really, you know, full of fear or anger, we need to bring some kindness to that, rather than let that run the show. One of the clinical psychologists who's called Mary Welford, who I'm a bit of a fan of, she talks about them in terms of them being like apps, sort of like phone apps, and we need to be able to switch up to the right app. So one of the other things I like about this model is that basically what it's saying is we've got the kit for kindness. So sometimes you sort of sit down and you think loving kindness and think, oh, I just feel like an empty shell. But actually, I think it can be helpful just to know that we do have it there. It may take a bit of work, but we as it were, we have the kit for kindness. So yes, I'm going to look at a couple of applications. So I want to look first of all at communication and particularly digital communication. And then secondly, I want to look at forgiveness. So, first of all, communication. So the Buddha said, we're born with an axe in our mouth. And what he was getting at there is quite an image, is that we can, with our unskillful speech, if we're not careful with our speech, we can cut ourselves, we can harm ourselves. One might add that we can also easily hurt others. I think in the digital age, we could say that we're born with axes in our fingertips. I was actually thinking a bit more like Logan. Do you know the Marvel superhero? You have the spouts these like claws. It's a bit like that. There's more power and, well, potentially more damage that can happen, as well as there being, you know, the potential for great good as well. I'll come back to that in a moment. So, just staying with communication generally, fortunately we do have some advice from the Buddha. So there's a nice sutta called the Abhaya Sutta, in which Prince Abhaya, who was one of King Bimbisara's sons, but not the heir to the throne, who was, who of course killed his father. So Prince Abaya was put up, someone put him up, to try and catch out the Buddha. And what he was asked to do is to approach the Buddha and ask the Buddha whether he would use speech that is unwelcome and disagreeable to others. And the idea was that if the Buddha answered, yes, I do, the Prince of I would say, well, you're just like an ordinary person then, having this, as it were, horrible speech. And if he said no, then he would say, yeah, but you spoke something to one of your disciples, which was rather unwelcome, this particular disciple called Devadatta. So Prince Abaya goes to the Buddha. Of course, the Buddha's much wiser than that and doesn't fall into the yes-no trap, but sort of says, basically, it's a bit more complicated than that. But what he comes out with is some criteria for communication. So, first, it should be truthful. Secondly, it should be beneficial, so it should be helpful. And the Buddha says that even if it's true and it would be welcome to the person, if it's not beneficial, the Buddha won't say it. So I think the sort of thing you might have been thinking of is sort of like flattery. So it might actually be true, and the person might feel really great when you tell them that, but actually, if it doesn't seem to be something that's going to be helpful, the Buddha won't say it. And then the third thing that he says is about finding the right time. So, if it's something that's true, if it is helpful, and if it would be welcome, still the Buddha finds the right time to say it. But equally, if it's true, it's helpful, but it's going to be disagreeable and unwelcome, the Buddha finds the right time to do it. I remember one of my friends saying someone had some feedback they wanted to give him, which was quite difficult feedback, and actually probably quite useful feedback, but he gave it to him just about as he was about to deliver a talk, which was like not really the best time to give it. So yeah, we want to try and find the right time. So, so I think these things are, you know, particularly even more relevant if we look at the digital age that we're in. So clearly, with using the internet, the whole variety of platforms and all sorts of ways that we can use technology, we can reach loads more people. So that's, it's got really can be really, really fantastic. I was at a order weekend this weekend, and someone there was just mentioning about an order member called Jai Mitra, who's in the London region, who's actually dying from cancer. We'd been up in the middle of the night, and he'd just written about what was going on for him on Facebook, there's an order sort of Facebook thing. And within a space of a few hours, a whole set of people from all around the world, like America and, wherever people were awake at that time, had, just written nice things into him, which is just sort of, really lovely that, somebody could be sort of met in that way very quickly by a lot of people all around the world. So there's something that can be really, really quite lovely, and there's so much great potential. But of course, also correspondingly, there's more room for damage, as it were. First of all, thinking about truthfulness, we're probably increasingly familiar with this idea of fake news, or think of, as for myself working in the NHS, the painfulness of the pre-Brexit, the NHS is going to get all this money, which I never believed at the time, and of course was, made up. So one thing is that, with digital thing, it can reach a lot of people. It's also, of course, it's likely to stay around longer. If you just speak something, it's in a sense, it's gone, even though it may have an effect. But the other thing is that we have less data about the recipients of who we're communicating with. So I was just a bit struck by this reason. I was at home and just witnessed a little incident that happened on the stairs. So this wasn't actually digital, this was a face-to-face thing. So one guy just asked somebody else, he said, "Are you in for dinner?" And the other guy said, "No." And the first guy said, "Oh, good." And then I think he maybe saw the confused look on the other person's face. And he said, "Oh, no, I don't mean good that you're not in for dinner. I mean good because I'm making dinner, so I need to know how many. And also, actually, this particular person really hates cooking and feels he's not very good at it. So it's like, oh, phew, it's one less person to cook for." So, you know, he was able to, you know, he saw what happened and was able to respond to it. But if it hadn't have been face-to-face, you imagine a little text exchange like that, it could have easily led to a misunderstanding. You know, quite sort of innocent, but easily led to a misunderstanding. I don't know if you've had that. I've certainly had that with text, and particularly with someone who I was in a newish relationship with, and sometimes I'd get a text and I'm thinking, is this humorous or is this actually someone is he actually a bit annoyed with me? And it could sometimes be a bit difficult to tell, and then I'm sort of not quite sure how to respond. I mean, emoticons can help, but it's like it's not the full it's not the full, you know, full thing. So yeah, so I think so we don't have so much information about the person on the receiving end, and so it does make empathy a bit harder, because when we're face to face, we so rely on all sorts of non-verbal communications, and then we can respond to people accordingly. If we see that it's what we thought was like completely straightforward is like meeting with disbelief or something, we can, you know, clarify or backtrack or, you know, respond differently. So, so we're in a way with the digital thing, we're much more sort of in a way alienated from our audience. And I think, you know, whether, you know, in our home or our office, it's so easy sort of behind, you know, in the safety of behind a screen, sort of easier to maybe say things that we wouldn't perhaps say face to face, or would at least say more carefully face to face. So I've got a few little recommendations for online use. So first of all, check our sources. I think it's so easy to be careless and to take what we've heard on face value without checking our sources. So it's easy to promote things that are untrue. So check our sources. Secondly, check on motivation. So is it actually the threat thing that's driving us, or the reward? You know, we've got such a, you know, I include myself, a strong desire to, you know, sort of appear clever or to get one over someone. It's kind of a sort of natural response. It reminded me of, I'm just going to read you a little poem, a little poetic interval. This poem by Billy Collins called Child Development, which I rather like. As sure as prehistoric fish grew legs and sauntered off the beaches into forests, working up some irregular verbs for their first conversation, so 3-year-old children enter the phase of name-calling. Every day a new one arrives and is added to the repertoire. You dumb goopy head. You big sewer face. You poop on the floor. A kind of Navajo ring to that one. They yell from knee level, their little mugs flushed with challenge. Nothing Samuel Johnson would bother tossing out in a pub, but then the toddlers are not trying to devastate some fatuous enlightenment hack. They're just tormenting their fellow squirts or going after the attention of the giants way up there with their cocktails and bad breath, talking baritone nonsense to other giants, waiting to call them names after thanking them for the lovely party and hearing the door close. The mature save their hot head invective for things, an errant hammer, tire chains, or receding trains missed by seconds. But they know in their adult hearts, even as they threaten to banish Timmy to bed for his appalling behaviour, that their bosses are big, fatty stupids, their wives are dopey dopeheads, and that they themselves are Mr. Sillypants. So, yeah, I quite like that. Anyway, it's a little poetic interlude. But it's something about, I think it's just like, it's sort of natural, that sort of like, you know, we've got that within us. And it can easily sneak out. So we just sort of, in a way, need to be careful, need to be extra mindful. Then the third thing is, I think when we're doing things online, or about sending emails or whatever it is to really reflect on how is this likely to be received. Could it be misinterpreted? And then fourthly, reread before sending. I mean, absolutely always do that. I mean, I always read my emails again before I send them, and amazed at the number of times the typos that slip in. And, you know, usually it's kind of innocent and not a problem, but sometimes you can miss out, or I've noticed I've missed out a knot, you know, which then completely switches round the meaning of the thing, which, you know, maybe someone would work out, but, you know, we can save ourselves a lot of trouble by just rereading. So that's communication. I'm going to go on to forgiveness now. So this is really about how do we respond to hurt? What happens when somebody hurts us? Well, of course, the temptation, we could even say that in a way, the sort of natural response is want to blame. It's a sort of quite understandable. We're hurt and we want to find someone to blame. Or we fall into self-pity. And with that blame can go righteous indignation, especially if you're, you know, unjustly wronged. And we can also then get into sort of wanting to flaunt our hurt for sympathy. I've certainly noticed that in myself. If I've got a good hurt story, I also want to, oh, wonderful. I mean, it's not that it consciously goes on, but I start telling it and thinking, oh, wait a minute, what you're doing is, you know, just eliciting sympathy, because you know that people go, oh, that's terrible, oh, awful, that's really awful. So the Buddha is very clear about this. He says in the Dhammapada, those who entertain such thoughts as, he abused me, he beat me, he conquered me, he robbed me, will not still their hatred. So basically what it's saying is that blame doesn't work. It doesn't work for us. It doesn't work for the other person. Again in the Dhammapada, not by hatred are hatreds ever pacified here in the world. They are pacified by love. This is the eternal law. So it doesn't work because what so easily happens is we get into this sort of reinforcing cycle. So we feel hurt. Understandably, we want to blame and or fall into pity. We then sort of ruminate over that. We let that turn over in our mind. We end up sort of nursing something of a grudge and we create more pain. And it sort of leads to what I think of as a sort of hardening of the heart. You get a nice sort of little version of this in Blake's Poison Tree. One bit of it goes like this. I was angry with my foe. I told it not. My wrath did grow. And I watered it in fears, night and morning with my tears. And I sunned it with smiles and with soft, deceitful wiles. Yeah, soft, deceitful wiles, a bit unpleasant, isn't it? You can get that sort of sense of how we can sort of hold on and nurse grudges. But as I say, it just causes us more suffering, let alone if, you know, effects on others. So my suggestion, and it can only be a suggestion, is that really the only solution ultimately is forgiveness, is to bring metta to the situation. Now that doesn't mean pretending that hurt hasn't happened. It doesn't mean saying, oh yeah, that's really fantastic that so-and-so did me over in whatever way they did me over, or that was really good that I was done over like that. It doesn't mean any of that. It is about creatively responding to the hurt. Again, Bhante says, feeling metta does not blind you to the facts. If someone is greedy or stupid, you see that they are. But with metta, you can always see through that greed or stupidity to the beauty of the human being. It is through metta that you can hold the two together, the ugly truth and the beautiful reality. So anyway, it's quite a sort of vision of what we're trying to do with metta. And someone called Lewis B. Smeads, he says, to forgive is to set a prisoner free and to discover that the prisoner was you. So yes, I find that very striking in a way. It's about, particularly it's about liberating ourselves. Because when we don't forgive, it ties us into pain. And there have been quite a lot of studies done on forgiveness, and what you find is that people who forgive are less likely to feel anxiety, depression, use unhelpful substances. They have greater emotional stability and life satisfaction, and it even seems to be protective to the heart. Again, interesting sort of connection between heart and kindness. So, for example, one little study they did is got people to think about an offence, to either think about it with a forgiving attitude or with an angry attitude, or just to distract themselves. They then were distracted for 5 minutes and then told to think about the event again. And what they found is that compared to the other two groups, the forgiving group stopped fluctuations in their blood pressure straight away and for some time afterwards. So they're much more, you know, settled. They're much, you know, their cardiovascular system was not troubled in the way that it was by people who were not forgiving. So how do we do this? So I think it is quite a process, again, depending, you know, what the hurt has been. I remember quite a few years ago, one of my friends hurt me in a way, which of course I felt was unjustified. He hurt me, and what I noticed is that, you know, I really did my best to be friendly, to be polite, but somewhere it's like my heart had closed. And I couldn't just sort of immediately just get it right, open it up in a way. It did feel like it took literally years of work to sort of gradually open my heart. So I think there's a number of things we can do. I think we can first of all reflect on whether we think forgiveness is desirable or not. Because obviously we don't think it is. There's no point in trying to do it. In a way, you can think of forgiveness as a present. It's almost like the give in forgiveness. It's like we're giving something in a way to the other person by forgiving them. Then I think we can try and meet the hurt that we've experienced with kindness, particularly working on the body level, feeling the hurt, because there will be a body element to it, and we can bring kindness to that. And part of the forgiveness may be forgiving ourselves. So forgiving ourselves for our responses, our angry responses, forgiving ourselves perhaps for letting ourselves get into the situation where we got hurt in the first place. So that might be a part of it. And then I think we can try and seek to understand the other person. As far as I'm aware, there aren't lots of Buddhas in the world, and given that, people will make mistakes. You know, so even if it's not deliberately harmful towards us, we will get hurt. You know, we're driven by craving and ill will, and we'll get hurt. And, you know, one way that I find it quite helpful is to think about is sort of other people, if you like, doing the best they can, given that the conditions that they find themselves in. Again, you might not share that view, but it's certainly a view that I find is quite helpful for working with people. And then we can just try and act with kindness. As Bante said somewhere, well, it was in Berlin actually, we can't always be happy, but we can be friendly. So we can try and act with friendliness towards the other person. If there is somebody else who is hurt, then of course we want to respond with kindness towards them, with sympathy, with compassion. There's a lovely word in Buddhism called anukampa, which is sometimes translated as sympathy or compassion, but it literally means to tremble with. So it's like really feeling with somebody else's hurt. So that's what we want to try and do. What we don't want to do, which again we have to watch out for, is getting drawn into righteous indignation ourselves on behalf of the other person. Because it can be, if we're not careful, you can end up with sort of moralism that's disguised as metta, that's got the label of metta on the top, but actually it's a bit unforgiving, harsh and judgmental. And that doesn't help the person who's been hurt, because they remain stuck in the victim mode. And it doesn't help us, because it just reinforces our egoism, even though we might feel great because we're, you know, righteous indignation. I mean, it is so tempting, righteous indignation. It's got such a... You just feel so good. So it's really, really have to watch out for it, I think. And then, I think, you know, ideally, again, this thing of the Buddha, when the time is right, help others to respond to that hurt dharmically. So we know, as you know, those of us who consider ourselves Buddhists, that the nature of existence includes pain, that is an escapable element of our existence. And sometimes we can maybe find that there sometimes can be a belief that, you know, we're doing all this wonderful Dharma practice, and therefore we shouldn't suffer, or bad things shouldn't happen to us. And of course, life isn't like that, even if we're practicing the Dharma. We may be able to attenuate and alleviate aspects of our pain, our suffering rather, but painful things will happen. And it's not that there's something wrong, it's actually something that we can actually usefully reflect on. And so we can try and help each other to reflect on that. And also just to sort of encourage, nudge towards forgiveness where that seems possible for the other person. So last thing I want to talk about is this thing about metta as a path and expression to the goal. So, you know, I've mentioned that metta, when it's fully developed, it's unconditional. So it's given up all desire for retaliation. It feels love for all beings. So, in other words, it goes beyond a sort of distinction between self and other. It goes to, in other words, egolessness. And I think part of the reason for talking about forgiveness is you get a bit of a taste of that with forgiveness. It's sort of going, it's moving in that direction of attenuating the distinction between self and other, which is one of the reasons I think it is such an important spiritual practice. Again, from living with kindness, to miss the link between metta and insight is to miss the point of metta entirely. So, we often think in terms of insight or in terms of the nature of reality in cognitive terms. So we think of it in terms of impermanence, insubstantiality, and, as I mentioned, the painful nature of reality. And I think that's really, really helpful. And, you know, I think as a community we've been doing more and more to sort of work on that and to really see that more and more fully. And I think that's really helpful. I mean, partly it's sort of in a way it's very clear. So I think what we want with that, and hopefully that, you know, should come with the more we sort of see this thing more fully, is not just a sort of cool appraisal of those facts, if you like, but more the sort of effective and volitional side. And I think this is what Metta can draw out, the effective and volitional aspects of insight or of reality. So again, one take. If you are able to act out of metta, if you treat others just as you treat yourself, you're acting as if the distinction you unthinkingly create in your mind between yourself and others simply did not exist. In doing so, you free yourself from the power of the illusion of a separate self. So, I think the more that we do this, not only do we have this sort of attitude of loving kindness towards those we meet, but it more and more gets expressed in friendship. It's that way we're doing this, and particularly where we're doing it with other people, then friendships is a sort of natural response. And I think it's quite significant that the Buddha created a Sangha. And I don't think he did this just to pass on his understanding about how things were, although clearly that's, you know, important. But almost, I think you could say that in a way that metta, in a sense, is the fabric of the universe. It's a natural response to when we understand how things are. So, as I say, metta is both a goal and a path that leads, that implies both friendship and spiritual community or sangha. So I'd just like to end with an image. So we've got Buddha Day coming up soon, and there we celebrate the enlightenment of the Buddha. And one of the sort of famous sort of like mythical stories associated with the Buddha's enlightenment. So when he's meditating under the Bodhi tree, just before he's enlightened, and he is assaulted by, referred to as Mara or Mara's horde. So he's assaulted by these, if you like, demons, which you can think of as representing the forces of craving, of hatred, of confusion, of ignorance, but which in the story are represented as arrows and other weapons, and these are all thrown at the Buddha. But as they reach the Buddha, they're just transformed into flowers that fall to the ground. So I think, for me, that's quite a beautiful image for the nature of metta. It's like it takes in what is, or receives what is difficult and painful, and transforms it into something beautiful. And the more we inhabit a world of metta, the more we'll see the world as beautiful. And indeed, it's one of the, it's traditionally seen as one of the fruits, is that we ourselves will appear more beautiful. So, we can all look forward to that. So there are a lot of arrows in the world, so let's make some more flowers.